This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. After the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first satellite into space, the United States found itself in a space race. It was a matter of national defense, and it was a race we won. We dedicated ourselves to being the master of the final frontier, putting men on the moon, sending probes to Mars and other planets, even the outer solar system, participating in the International Space Station, and providing scientists and the rest of the world with the Hubble Space Telescope and the amazing views it has provided of our universe. That was accomplished through NASA, an agency of the federal government. But for years, the government has been backing away from space as the private sector has begun to step in. SpaceX billionaire Elon Musk's company has been successfully launching rockets that not only deliver cargo to the space station, but also feature boosters that successfully return to the Earth in an upright position ready to be used again. With the Trump administration's planned defunding of the space station by 2025, American astronauts could be left grounded and NASA with little to do and no plans to go anywhere unless something changes. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? What do we gain and what do we lose if NASA becomes a shadow of its former self or merely ceases to exist? Just how important is our presence in space and our exploration of it? We're going to talk about that this hour with Joan Higginbotham. She is a Charlottean and former NASA astronaut. She used the word retired a moment ago, but she's not old enough. Who spent 308 hours in space on board the International Space Station, among other jobs with NASA through the years. Thank you for being here. Nice to meet you.
My pleasure.
She's in our Spirit Square studio, and joining us via Skype is Tariq Malik, reporter and managing editor of Space.com. He's covered space news and science for 13 years. Tariq, thank you for being here this morning as well.
A pleasure. Thanks.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can also watch us this morning on Facebook Live. Since the 1980s, when the U.S. was still flying regular shuttle missions, I've been having conversations on the radio with listeners and others about space and our nation's space program, and to me at least, there were a alarmingly large number of people who advocated that the government get out of the business, that we had no business funding these ridiculous programs, these voyages into nowhere and back, with nothing that they could tangibly put their fingers on as the benefit of it all. You're nodding your head because you recognize this, Joan. They saw no value in it. So let me hear from both of you about this, and I'll start with Joan. If you think the U.S. has benefited from the NASA space program, how have we benefited?
Oh, absolutely. So if you have a cell phone in your hand today, you have benefited from the space program. There's so much technology that has come out of the program. I think the problem is with the communication of what has come from the program and how it has tangibly benefited the U.S. citizens.
Because Tang usually comes to mind.
Tang and ice cream dots or something like that, yes. And so I think the onus is really on NASA. And I recognize this when I first began with NASA. So I started in 1987, fresh out of college, and not knowing a lot about the space program, honestly. That was not my intended career path. I was going to go work for IBM, but, you know, fate intervened, and I found myself at the Kennedy Space Center, and this was roughly 6 months before they got back to return to flight with STS-26 after Challenger. And being totally green about the space program and coming in and reading the literature and what has happened, I can understand how the American public doesn't understand or get the benefits, because it's not very well communicated.
Wow.
You had a very beautiful, glossy magazine that the IP, or the international partner, principal investigator, put together at such a high level that only other PIs and scientists who understood that language could understand what was being said in the beautiful, glossy magazine.
Well, you don't put out a beautiful, glossy magazine, Tariq, but you do put out a beautiful, glossy website every day, space.com. And tell me, from your point of view, because I know you've been a space enthusiast since you were a kid, what have gained from this.
Well, you are right. I mean, I've been to space camp 5 times, once as an adult. So I have been a fan since I was a kid. And I grew up with the space shuttle program as kind of like the the goal or the pinnacle of space exploration at that time as a kid. And you know, just the fact that you and I are talking over an internet system, Skype, you know, while a major storm is hitting us here in the Northeast, is an example of a lot of the benefits that we have gotten from.
Explain why. Tell me what Skype and the internet has to do with outer space.
Well, we are talking over a communication network that is bouncing signals either through fiber optic cables and through satellites. You know, a network that was pioneered by a lot of the work that NASA did in the early days and over the 60s and 70s to develop satellite communications networks. And then through the space shuttle program, launching those satellites for commercial companies that set up the infrastructure that we use on a regular basis. And now, as the fruits of that labor, you know, you mentioned SpaceX and others, companies are developing new satellites for internet services only. So websites like space.com, the Skype systems that you use with your guests, they'll be routed through those satellites even now, you know, and through the future. So there is a direct line between the technology that was developed through the space program or for the space program, to the everyday systems that we use and rely on to get our weather forecast for this storm that I'm watching outside my window.
Right. We tend to forget about satellites, and we use satellites every day without even knowing it. That little weather thing that you get on your phone with the radar and the maps and things like that, that's all from satellites. And the fact that we have international telephone calls, all from satellites, pretty much. We forget about that. Coast-to-coast television used to be a big deal. It's nothing now, because it's all done by satellites. NPR comes to you via a satellite. I remember when it came to you on a phone line. So that's all from space. But there's a difference between putting unmanned objects into space that serve us on the Earth and manned space flight. What have we gained since you've been in outer space, Joan? What have we gained from manned space flight?
So it's interesting because there are people who would advocate for putting robots or machines or whatever in space, and there's an argument to be made for that. But sometimes there are things that occur in space that you need human beings to intervene. And so to that end, there has to be some type of collaboration between machine and man, because there is a human interaction that is needed. For us, I'll just give you an example. So part of our mission was to electrically reconfigure the space station because it's on a power grid through solar arrays. Okay. And because we didn't put all the pieces of the space station up in order, you know, we temporarily located things on piece parts on the station. So one of the things that we had to do was to relocate a solar array so that we'd have power. The solar array theoretically was just going to fold up very nicely in its little box and we were just going to move it. Well, it had been out there for 5 years. It didn't want to fold up very nicely. And as we went to do that maneuver, it got stuck. And we needed human intervention to go out and do that. And so there are just some things that you need humans to go out and do.
Well, that leads the whole question of the space station, which we will talk about later on. And you used, Tarek, the word commercial. Spaceflight for the longest time has been the province of governments, the Chinese government, the American government, the Russian government. And now we're moving into this era where commercial enterprises are getting involved, not just sending up their satellites on NASA rockets, but sending their own rockets up. Elon Musk, I think Jeff Bezos is involved in this as well. Should space and access to it be the exclusive province of governments, or is it a good thing that commercial enterprises are getting involved? Tarek.
Well, you know, I am, you know, staunchly on the side of that it is a good thing. Now, one thing that has been clear over just the last decade of NASA's work, as well as, you know, the other space agencies around, is that while they can do some things great, there are other things that commercial companies can do for them. And allow maybe NASA to pursue something even grander. Instead of having kind of one space program in the United States right now, there's something like five. You've got SpaceX. Jim, you mentioned Jeff Bezos and his Blue Origin mission. There's Virgin Galactic in Southern California trying to build suborbital tourist ships. So you have these different niches now that companies can fill and allow NASA to kind of let those efforts go by, maybe even become a customer like we're seeing now, while they go on to a grander goal. Now that NASA's direction is to get astronauts back to the moon, and they can focus on that and not have to worry about the other things that lead to that, getting astronauts into space. NASA is going to fly astronauts on SpaceX's Dragon capsule. And Boeing, they have their own space capsule called the Starliner. And that will serve that role that will allow NASA to build their deep space spacecraft, Orion. So, you know, I think that they have kind of a support structure role. And clearly, there is a business case for these companies because they're not in it altruistically. They want to make money. And so they've got customers lined up. SpaceX has been launching commercial satellites in addition to its role as a provider for NASA for years. And that industry is really kind of swinging into full gear as NASA kind of aims a bit further out, back to the moon, onto Mars, and is able to kind of focus its resources now on the vehicles, the science, the technologies to make that further goal possible.
So that's a journalist's point of view. Let me hear an astronaut's point of view. And I'll let you speak for all of NASA this morning, Joan Higginbotham. Is NASA happy to give up their hegemony over outer space in the United States? Or is it being forced to do this simply because of the realities of politics in America today? Or is it because they have pretty much mastered suborbital space and now they really want to press out into other parts of our galaxy, and they'll leave the hometown stuff to commercial interests?
So I cannot speak for NASA or on behalf of NASA, so unfortunately we're not even going to go there. I'm speaking solely for Joan Higginbotham and her opinion. So I actually happen to agree with Tarek. I think it's great that we have other people that are getting into the business. I think it promotes competition, friendly competition, in that you're now trying to make sure that you have a great product. And I think it spurs innovation as well. And so I think it's a great thing to do. And to his point, then yes, maybe NASA can think about overall big picture strategy, what they want to do next. And
given the fact that people sometimes have, after all these years, haven't bought in to the space program, do you think that when people like Jeff Bezos and his Blue Origin company, which plans to have people in suborbital space by the end of this year, he says, now these will be rich people because it's going to cost a lot of money to go up.
Yes, it is.
But do you think the ability of ordinary people to go up will excite people to the point where they'll understand what you understand as a former astronaut?
Well, one can hope. Hopefully it will. I think there's always a cadre of people who were just very excited about it. And so when we went out as an astronaut, I mean, they were just all for it, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you have these rich people who go up and maybe have another median into which they can talk about how great this is, maybe that's just, now that we have social media, maybe it'll just explode and blow up and they'll understand the excitement around it. And not just how cool it is, but, you know, it's a good thing to do.
Joan Higginbotham is a former NASA astronaut. We're going to talk about her experiences in space a little bit later. Tarek Malik is also with us, a reporter and managing editor for Space.com, who's been up in the Vomit Comet. We can talk about that experience too, Tarek, when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about space and America's participation, ongoing participation in space, and how the paradigm is shifting from a strictly NASA government-controlled operation to something more commercial as we go forward. Joan Higginbotham is with us, a former NASA astronaut and a charlatan. And Tarek Malik is a reporter and managing editor of Space.com. He joins us via Skype this morning. Vice President Mike Pence has said that to stay in the lead in space, the U.S. would need to, quote, streamline regulations to accelerate commercial space ventures. I'm not sure what that means, but is it because of competition from other nations who are moving into commercial space? Is it because this administration simply wants out of the near space business? Is it because this is the next inevitable step in man's exploration of what President Kennedy called the final frontier? Tarek?
Well, you know, what the vice president was really talking about is to kind of streamline the process that companies face, both kind of getting clearance to launch their vehicles and then to develop new vehicles in the past. You know, one kind of pain point that some companies have found is when they build and design one rocket. SpaceX is an example. They have a Falcon 9 rocket, and they have to get a special kind of certification to launch it from Florida versus a different kind of certification to launch it from their launch pad in California. It's the same rocket, and nothing has changed except they're launching it from a different place, and yet they have to kind of recertify the whole vehicle all over again. And that's the kind of regulations that Mike Pence was really talking about, those types of kind of redundant or perhaps overbearing certifications that some companies have to go through to fly every single time. And that can be a pain point for SpaceX in particular. They're trying to launch maybe every other week or so, sometimes within a given week on different coasts.
Well,
and so
he's called these regulations redundant, sometimes contradictory. They slow down innovative ideas like satellite refueling efforts, things like that. But isn't there a certain amount of, I'm going to coin a phrase here, overcaution that is necessary when you're launching what is essentially a bomb into the air? Shouldn't we be extremely cautious about this?
I do agree with you there, Mike. Caution is very important. You know, space is very unforgiving, especially for these companies. SpaceX, again, you know, I know we talk about them a lot, but they've had two failures within 2 years. In 2015, a launch failure when they were actually launching an unmanned cargo ship, pardon me, uncrewed cargo ship to the space station for NASA, and that rocket just broke apart and exploded on the way up. And then they had a rocket on the launch pad in Florida that exploded while they were gearing up for a test. Now they were able to survive those two experiments and come back, or those two anomalies and come back. But other companies may not. And so, you know, maintaining that vigilance is a business necessity too for these companies.
You're an engineer, Joan. And we've been launching rockets since World War II, and big rockets since the 1960s and 70s and 80s. Why do rockets still blow up on launch? Why haven't we perfected that? Cars don't blow up. Why do rockets?
Because things can go wrong. So
it can go wrong in everything.
they can, but it's very complicated. So let me go back to the shuttle. So when I was interviewing, I got a chance to go down to the Kennedy Space Center. And they took me into the orbital processing facility, the big garage where they got the shuttles ready to go out to the launch pad. And this is right after Challenger. So the shuttle, I'd say it had all the guts out. So I went in, it had all the panels out, miles and miles of wiring. And the very first thought that went through my head was, why doesn't this blow up more often? And I don't mean that from a horrible, I wasn't trying to be nasty about it, but I said it from the fact that there are so many intricacies and so many things that have to go right one step after another for the shuttle to get launched. It was just amazing to me that there weren't more accidents.
When you went to the space station, what vehicle did you go off on?
We were on Space Shuttle Discovery.
So you went up on a space shuttle, and that was
Absolutely. After
Challenger, right?
Actually, it was the third launch after the breakup of Columbia.
Okay.
So yet another accident.
So tell me what went through your head, when they said you're going, or when you said, okay, I'll go. I guess you have a choice.
I did, yes.
And B, when you were sitting on the launch pad in the spaceship, and then it ignited.
So a couple of things for me. I am just a firm believer that when it's your time to go, it's your time to go. And I tell people I've probably had more near misses on I-77 than I have on the shuttle. And to me, one of the safest times to launch was right after an accident, because you know the engineers were combing through everything with a fine-tooth comb. Besides that, I worked on the shuttle as an engineer for 9 years. I knew the people. I knew their hearts, and their hearts were in the right place. Their sole mission was to deliver a safe vehicle to the astronauts. So when I was sitting on that bomb, if you will, the last thing going through my mind was, oh, what's going to happen? The first thing that was going through my mind was, hey, let's go because I have a job to do and I want to make sure I don't mess it up.
For most people who don't have a chance to be in a space shuttle and on the way to the space station, we have our image of outer space from film and television, and there seem to be two paradigms floating around. There's the Star Trek paradigm, where the Federation controls all of the starships, and their mission is peace and do no harm. And then Star Wars, where the galactic empire tries to control everything, but everything that they don't try to control is run by commercial enterprises that are slipshod and shoddy at best. We have these two images that come into our head. As more commercial interests enter space, are we witnessing, a new kind of space race, and are we going to see what we see in Star Wars? Toby on Twitter says, save NASA, make a list of all the technology and knowledge gained from the space program, then ask, do we really want that placed in the hands of a corporate giant? That is when it may not help us at all anymore. Corporations will control that knowledge. NASA needs marketing. So, Tarek, are we entering a new kind of space race as commercial enterprises get involved in this? And do we want this kind of activity?
Well, you know, I think that there is a clear competition between many of the companies out there. Elon Musk, you know, is building a giant rocket. And he launched a car into space. Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin, they're building a giant rocket, and they've assured that they'll launch something interesting into space. They have different goals, but they are trying to do kind of the same thing. And then you have some other smaller companies that are trying to corner the market for space tourism as well. So there is kind of a competitive race going on to show who has the best vehicle, can launch the most payload or the most affordable rocket too, going on. On the services side of, you know, watching companies that either need to fly in space or people that can afford to buy a ticket to space, you know, that's great to kind of see that competition going on, because you're going to get different vehicles, different spacecraft. There's a slightly competitive goal of trying to build a private space station in space too, to give folks a destination once they get up there.
The American space effort, and I'm assuming by extraction the old Soviet space program and now the Russian one and the Chinese space program, seem to be monstrously expensive ventures, or they have been for NASA if you look at the price tags on things. And President Trump, in talking about the recent launch of the SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket and its success in landing two side boosters so they can be used again, said that it cost SpaceX $80 to $90 million to do that. He said if the government did it, the same thing would have cost probably 40 or 50 times that amount of money. Is he correct? Can private industry participate in space cheaper than NASA? And if so, why?
Just to that point, you know, and Joan, you can correct me, but the figure that we got during the space shuttle era is each shuttle flight cost on the order of a couple billion dollars. NASA's space launch system, which they're developing to launch the Orion spacecraft for those deep space missions, you know, they're looking at, you know, $1 billion plus price tag per flight. And SpaceX is clearly marketed their Falcon Heavy boosters to fly on the order of 90 million or so, which is substantially less than those $1 billion plus price tags. And if they can continue to build that rate, they have a similar low price for their Falcon 9 launches, then they can really, kind of show what they're able to do on a cost-effective strategy. And so,
that's the cost differential is amazing. I mean, $1 billion versus $1 million is amazing. So when you're talking about a $90 million versus, what was the billion-dollar figure you threw out a second ago? What was that?
It's they're between like $1 and $2 billion.
There you go. That's an astounding difference. And how can they do it so cheaply?
They have SpaceX in particular, but also Blue Origin too with their suborbital rockets, and Virgin Galactic what they're doing with suborbital vehicles too. They've developed their systems to be as efficient as possible because they are companies that need to be as efficient as possible to keep their costs down and get a return on the investment that they're putting in. When the company that built the first private crewed vehicle to fly in space, Scaled Composites, launched their Spaceship One in 2004 with a pilot on it. Paul Allen, the investor and Microsoft co-founder, had invested something like 100 times or 10 times the prize package that spaceship won. It won a $10 million prize. They had spent something like $100 million on it to prove that technology. And that's that kind of investment they want to get back over time. And that's why SpaceX has tried to keep their costs down. They try to optimize their production to make sure that they're building the most efficient vehicle. And then they're trying to reuse those vehicles over and over again, because the more you reuse a vehicle, cheaper. You're not throwing it out, the cheaper that it'll be.
So Jones, having worked at NASA as an engineer, as an electrical engineer and in many different capacities in the space program before you ever flew a mission, is NASA more expensive because they are pioneering, they're inventing things, or they're working with outside vendors to invent new pieces of equipment, new vehicles, new capsules, new propulsion systems, et cetera, to get us up there and trying to make sure that nothing goes wrong because it would not look good for the United States government when things go wrong? Or is it the fact that people like SpaceX, that companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin are simply taking technology that NASA has created and mastered and using it, so it's cheaper for them?
It's probably a little bit of both. You have to remember that when the shuttle program was put into place, when they were selling it, if you will, to Congress, the intent was for it to launch quickly. They were going to say it was going to, take off like an airplane, come back and land. Mm-hmm. They'd refurbish it really quickly, and it would get up again. So the whole thing was, as Tarek was saying earlier, was the cost per mission was supposed to be low because they were supposed to launch it quickly and multiple times. Unfortunately, that quite didn't come to fruition. I think the shortest turnaround time that we ever had with a vehicle processing it was about 6 months, and that it was very quick. And I think it was we were trying to fix, I don't know if it was a Hubble mission or something, but that was the quickest turnaround time for a mission. Normally, it was anywhere between 9 months plus.
Would private companies be in space or trying to get into space today had there never been a NASA?
That's a good question. I would think that as human beings, we would want to explore. So I think at some point, we probably would have gotten companies to come in and start doing mm-hmm. this. I think NASA was the impetus and the precursor to all this happening, and so I think you have to give them their kudos and the credit for what's been happening in the past couple of years.
This may not be true, but just from reading some of the comments being made that are coming out of the Trump administration about this, they seem to be seeing NASA and private space companies as having completely discrete missions, when in fact, and I could be wrong about that, but it seems to me that the two could function together, allowing NASA to do big things out further out, while using companies to take cargo to the space station or put new satellites up in the air and not be bothered with that anymore. Is that the better way to go?
I think so. They don't have to be mutually exclusive. Why can't, to your point, NASA have the bigger picture, as I said earlier, about strategy and doing maybe deep space things or mm-hmm. more exploratory things, and let the private companies do the suborbital type issues, resupply the space station, that type of thing. But it doesn't have to be a mutually exclusive club.
Elon Musk wasted a perfectly good automobile recently by launching it into space. It could have been mine. Of course, I couldn't afford it, but nonetheless, it could have been mine. But he sent this rocket up, and I'm told, Tarek, that this is the most powerful rocket in the world. Is this more powerful than the rocket that sent men to the moon? Is it more powerful than the rocket that sent space shuttles up, or merely the most powerful rocket currently available in the world?
So right now, Mike, the Falcon Heavy is the most powerful rocket currently available now. Okay. It can launch something like on the order of 50 tons or so of cargo into space. Or I could be a little wrong there, but it can launch twice as much cargo than the previous most powerful rocket, the Delta IV Heavy, built by United Launch Alliance. That's a partnership between Boeing and Lockheed Martin. But the Saturn V rocket that launched people to the moon was capable of lifting more cargo. It was more powerful. And so Elon Musk has said that they would need like two, possibly three Falcon Heavies to match that right now.
And they are working on a first stage booster and an upper stage spaceship for a Mars mission that would include colonization. Is that merely a vanity project for Elon Musk, or is there money to be made by a company who gets to Mars first?
Well, I think any company that gets to Mars first before NASA or another country or an international effort would have a lot of cachet if they could make that work.
Well, you know, this happened once before back in the 1600s. This happened with the East India Company, literally a private company going to India that eventually colonized India, brought vast armies to India, ruled India until the British took it over from these independent companies. This is what are we going to have history repeating itself here?
Well, you know, I think time is going to tell there, Mike, but Elon has really said that the reason he founded SpaceX in 2002 was because he did see a need to found another outpost for humanity out there on Mars. That was like his end goal for the company. Making money in between to finance it all was part of that. But, you know, if SpaceX beats NASA or another company. Boeing's CEO recently said that he thinks they can beat SpaceX to Mars. So there's competition there on the business side. There's the potential to be a provider then to other space agencies. At one point, NASA was eyeing using some of SpaceX's technology for their own financed mission to Mars. So I think there's a little bit of both on those sides.
Elon Musk has a pretty dark vision of the future of Earth, which is one of his motivations for wanting to go to Mars. We can talk about that when we come back. And we can talk about going back to the moon, which is something that President Trump says he would like to do. Why go back? We'll find out. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about outer space, the future in space, how we got where we are, where we're going next, both with NASA and with commercial enterprises trying to put people and objects into space and take trips to foreign bodies. Joan Higginbotham is with us, a former NASA astronaut, a Charlottean. Tariq Malik is a reporter and managing editor of Space.com. The Trump administration is pushing to open the doors to greater commercial efforts in space. He's also directed NASA to focus on returning human beings to the moon, which will have people raising the question once again, why? Been there, done that. What more can we learn from another trip to the moon? Joan, what can we learn?
That's a really good question, to which I don't have a really good answer.
And some have said we can't go back because the institutional knowledge, we'd have to start over. The institutional knowledge that NASA had that got us there in the first place is gone.
Even when I started with NASA, there was a big gap there. There were a whole bunch of fresh outs, which I was fresh out of college. Mm-hmm. And then there was a big gap between the 20-somethings and people that were 35 and up. And so you had people that had been at NASA for 2 years and people that had been at NASA for 20 years. So a lot of that institutional knowledge is now gone.
It's part of the reason, if we really want to go into deep space, if we want to go to Mars or someplace else, that we will need newer technology. We'll need rockets. We'll need new capsules or spacecraft. We need landers, which will probably be more substantial than the moon landing lander that they used and left on the surface with every landing. We'll need a moon habitat, and I know that they want to build something like the space station that would orbit the moon as a kind of stopping off point, R&R, refueling, whatever you want to call it, place, and then move on from there. Is that why we need to go back? If we want to go further out, we need to go to the moon first?
That could be a potential. But to your point, if we want to go somewhere farther out, i.e. Mars, the biggest reason that we can't do that right now is we don't have the technology to get us there in a pretty efficient manner, in a quick manner. Right now, it's a 9-month trip one way.
So we've sent robots to Mars. The Mars rover is on Mars. Why do we need to go? Why do humans need to go? Would you want to go? You were an astronaut. You were up there. Would you want to go?
I would go if the technology was such that it would get you there in something less than 9 months. If it was a month-long trip there, I'd definitely go. And with the ability, of course, to come back home. So, yeah, I definitely would go, yes.
So since you write about all things space, Tarek, why Mars? What's so special about that red planet out there? Is it just because it's nearby? Is it because it's the most Earth-like planet? Is it because we really think we could colonize Mars, that people would want to live there, that they would be able to successfully survive life there?
Well, you know, it's kind of a mishmash of all of those things. You know, Mars has been kind of a dominant planet out of all of the others that we see in the night sky in our popular culture, because, you know, is there life there? We don't know. We can see the planet in the night sky. It's red, which is makes it stand out. But kind of more to that, it's the only planet that is relatively within reach that has an atmosphere that isn't so toxic like on Venus that it'll destroy your spacecraft or so inhospitable within a few minutes of landing. And yet it has these stark vistas that are really similar to what we see in the deserts on our own planets. So it's a really ripe target. You know, earlier you were talking to Joan and you asked, why send people there? You know, NASA has had a couple of rovers on the planet for years. The Opportunity rover has been kind of chugging along since 2004, and the Curiosity rover has been there since 2012. Both of those robots have done amazing things over the years. A scientist, Steve Squires at Cornell, you know, he led one of those missions, and he's like, you know, a geologist could do all of that in a couple of days. You know, the science would be that much faster, and it would show, or we could learn why Earth is so special. Why we you know, live here and not on Mars, or what might be out there if there are other planets similar to our Earth or to Mars, how life could survive there, and you know, finding some kind of example of something living on Mars would be huge.
That gets back to what you were talking about earlier about being on the space station. There are certain things that humans can do that machines cannot, or they need human assistance to do them, and we can do things quicker, easier.
Absolutely. And looking at the whatever soil you have and determining what components are in the soil, what nutrients and so forth, that can be done, you know, in a matter of days.
Elon Musk, who wants to go there, believes a Mars colony will save us from a future dark age that includes too much carbon. Of course, he's trying to sell that Tesla automobile. Too much carbon in the atmosphere. World War III. And runaway artificial intelligence. And he says this new dark ages for Earth that could be shortened if a group of humans could be away from the planet carrying the torch for humanity. What should we make of a comment like that?
Well, you know, everyone has an opinion of what's going to happen or what could possibly happen. So obviously that is his. The one thing that I would say is about the sustainability of Earth. And I can't predict how long it's going to be here and what's going to happen. But I can say that looking at all the photos from when NASA started to do Earth ops till when I launched, I haven't seen anything recent. You could see there is physical proof that the oceans are getting smaller, and where there was once water, there is now land. And so there is a case to be made that we are probably doing some harm to the Earth, and we need to be a little bit more vigilant about what we're doing. And it's really interesting. Everyone, I always get the question, well, what was the most surprising or thing, or did your view of Earth change? And the answer is kind of yes. So when I was up there about the second day, I went up to the flight deck and I just kind of strapped in and looked out the window. And it was we were flying so that we could see about an eighth of the curvature of the Earth. And as the sun was coming up, I could actually see the atmosphere, which from my vantage point looked about 2 millimeters thick, right? We all know it's a little more than that. But it just dawned on me how incredibly fragile the Earth is, because that's the only thing that was saving us from extinction. So when I saw that, what I said was, we really need to be very vigilant about how we're treating the Earth and what we're doing. Otherwise, we won't have an Earth. So
we'll be like Mars, just blue.
It may be. Who knows? But you know, we need to treat Earth very kind.
So you were in the you worked for the shuttle program for NASA,
yes.
you were on the International Space Station.
Yes.
And the president has said he wants to defund our participation in the space station by 2025, which is right around the corner, so that we can focus our money and attention on moon landings and other out-of-orbit projects. In your opinion, having been there and worked with other astronauts from other countries, is that the right way to go? Is there still a purpose for the International Space Station that America should participate in?
There is a purpose for the International Space Station, and it's basically a research vehicle. So the question really is...
Because its lifespan is 2028. It's only 3 years after he's proposing defunding it.
Mm-hmm.
So to keep it going, we'd have to rebuild it, wouldn't we?
You know, it depends, because originally we were told the lifespan was, I think it was right about now. And it was about this time that they were going to just let it kind of plunge into the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to remember that part of the astronaut's job on board is to take care of the space station. So there's a lot of maintenance going on every single day. And you could probably prolong the life, if you will.
The other argument, Tarek, is that the space station cost a lot more than we thought it was going to cost, evidently. We've spent, if these numbers are right, we've spent nearly $90 billion in construction and transportation costs to get everything up there, and about $3 to $4 billion a year to operate it. And it was initially designed to be both a science facility and a getaway, I think, to new deep space missions for NASA. But the cost of the space station itself has prohibited NASA from developing deep space missions. So if you jettison the space station, are you then able to do deep space missions?
Well, you know, this also came up during the wind down of the space shuttle era, Mike. You know, if you were not spending that $100 billion total on the space station, then you could use it for other, other uses. That's kind of what the current budget request for 2019 is looking to set the groundwork for that by the Trump administration. They're looking to spend, $19.9 billion, for NASA, but to wind down that investment on the station side and use it for deep space exploration. Now, there is a cost that comes in the maintaining of that vehicle. There was talk of replacing the space station with a new version of itself. Bill Gerstenmaier.
And could we rent that out to commercial enterprises and make a profit on it and then use that money to fund better projects, bigger projects for NASA?
And that's kind of what the current goal of the budget request now for NASA that the White House has put out is trying to say. You know, when we get to that end date for the station, we need to have those commercial uses in place if they want to keep it going, while NASA would then go and focus on the vehicles and programs that it needs for deep space exploration. If that market is there, that remains to be seen, though, because there are other folks that are trying to build their own, maybe more affordable private stations for their own use. So.
Here's a concern that a lot of people have. If I'm not mistaken, we have some sort of agreement, an international agreement, about not weaponizing space. Is that true? We don't put vehicles up in space that target objects on the Earth with weaponry. Although I'm told that the Chinese and the Russians are trying to develop anti-satellite weapons in the next few years to shoot satellites one satellite would shoot another satellite down. And we already have surveillance satellites and technologies to jam those satellites. If commercial enterprises get involved, do we lose control of all that? I mean, if I'm a businessman and I can launch a weaponized satellite that will shoot down another satellite or jam your satellite to my benefit, won't I do it?
You know, there is a treaty in place with the United Nations about, for the peaceful uses of outer space that would, kind of apply towards the non-weaponization of space and space access. And, we were talking earlier, it is a vital resource for a lot of the technologies we rely on for communication satellites, for navigation satellites, et cetera. But China, in particular, has tested an anti-satellite weapon. They did shoot down an old satellite with a missile and create a vast cloud of debris that is still up there today. The United States, to kind of counter that, shot down a falling satellite, a falling spy satellite, just a few years after that that China test to show that they had that capability as well. Now, those were using ground-based missiles shooting satellites out of space. You can see there is if tensions do rise, there is a kind of a worst-case scenario where if they do test one of those kinds of weapons in an operational orbit where those satellites work, that could completely saturate those orbits and destroy other satellites. That debris that they cause would affect not just another nation's satellite, their target, but every other satellite.
There was a movie about that showed what space debris can do to astronauts on doing spacewalks.
The risk is high, is all I wanted to mention. So.
Okay. We have a comment from Twitter. I had the opportunity, this person says, to take my children to the Kennedy Space Center last month. To see how amazed my children were by the space program was amazing. My 12-year-old daughter now wants to become an engineer for NASA or SpaceX. Space exploration inspires future scientists. You didn't get into the science business or the electrical engineering business, Joan, to become an astronaut, but you have a bachelor in science in electrical engineering. You have a master's in management. You have a master's in space systems. You thought you were going to go to IBM. You went to the Kennedy Space Center. At what point did you become a space enthusiast?
I became a space enthusiast probably about 6 months after I got there, and I saw my first launch. We were about 3.5 miles from the launch pad, the closest anyone can get. I was literally outside of at the time it was a government trailer, standing on the porch, and we watched STS-26 launch. And literally, tears almost streamed down my face. It was so amazing. It was so incredible just feeling the rumble of the ground as the shuttle took off and knowing that, you know, I had a hand in that. Not a big hand because I'd only been there 6 months, but I was sold.
Yeah. And eventually you went up there in outer, and you did a lot of things on the ground to help missions be successful. But let's talk about being up there. I know you get to ask this question all the time. What is launch like?
Launch is surreal. So you're in there for about 3 hours, laying on your back, waiting for T-minus zero. The first time for us was a little disappointing because we scrubbed due to weather. We got back in 2 nights later. I was pretty convinced it was not going to happen because the weather wasn't appreciably different from 2 nights earlier. But we got down to T-minus nine. Everybody gave us a go, and at T minus zero, we lifted off, and it was kind of a little kick in the pants. You're kind of jarred off the pad, and then you have a sense of the vehicle getting faster and faster. You get off the pad pretty quickly, and you start getting some traction pretty quickly. Mm. And at that point, you're really just going down, and you're tracking through the checklist, making sure everything goes okay.
I have less than a minute. What's it like to be weightless?
It's incredible. There is an art to floating. You think it's easy. It really isn't. You have to be very careful about how hard you push off from one surface so you don't go flying into another, or how softly you push off so you don't find yourself stranded in the middle of the space shuttle or station.
Not being able to move.
Fish out of water. Exactly. Exactly.
It's better than the vomit comet, though, right?
Way better.
Which Tarek has taken a trip on. Did you lose your cookies, Tarek?
I got close, but luckily they helped us. They helped us out. It was amazing, though.
Tarek Malik is a managing editor of space.com. Joan Higginbotham, a former NASA astronaut. Thank you both for the hour.